Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Nurses Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce you to our speaker for today, Head Oncology Nurse at the Royal Veterinary College, Nicola Reid. Thank you, Nicola. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Emma, for that introduction. Yes, my name is Nicola. I'm the head oncology nurse at the Royal Veterinary College, and it is my pleasure today to introduce you to a talk on nursing patients with cancer and nurse-led support service. So essentially, I work at the RVC since 2002, where I eventually have now sort of ended up in becoming a specialised oncology nurse. My training started since 2012, and I really, really have enjoyed this area of specialised veterinary nursing and have funnelled absolutely everything which I do into that now. I undertook a postgraduate certificate in oncology nursing with Harper Adams University in 2016, and somehow got embroiled into then doing a master's in veterinary nursing, with my research project being focused very much on oncology. I'm currently undertaking a postgraduate certificate in veterinary education with the RVC, so please forgive me, but it is essential that I develop my teaching catalogue and introduce a couple of learning theories hidden within these this talk today. So the aim really is an introductory course to give you the basic skills required for any nurses that are involved in administering chemotherapy in practice and those who want to extend their support to a nurse-led clinic. There's no requirements for being here today. There's no additional skills which you must have as a nurse who's wanting to train as an oncology nurse. It's just essentially that you want to be open-minded and extend your experience, your knowledge, and essentially develop a much more acute skill set. And so therefore you'll be able to undertake chemotherapy in practice with what you have already and hopefully branch that into something a little bit more specialised with regards to your patient and client care. The indications for today are really to design a learning session which integrates the educational development alongside practical and updated practice principles. So I really would like to extend the availability of cancer care into general practice, so to treat more patients. As a specialist nurse at a referral centre, we often see the patients come into us as with either newly diagnosed disease or unstable disease. And we would really, really love for the nurses in practice to take their own empowerment really and responsibility to be able to look after these patients in general practice and deliver their ongoing care. For me as a nurse trying to do that, there are a lot of social challenges in which there are influences where some colleagues know of or have heard of chemotherapy and have like a preconceived opinion, whether or not that's because the drugs that we use are particularly dangerous to the users, whether or not it's scary to the practitioners and they're worried that they can make a mistake. But I also find that there's actually really limited educational opportunities within veterinary education. It wasn't part of my nursing schooling in order to be taught how to undertake chemotherapy in practice. I learned probably an hour or so of it as a nurse in nursing school. And there's actually also very limited availabilities to the clinicians in practice, clinician schooling as well. So this is also a concept which we want to introduce as there's more patients being treated with cancer. So really, I suppose at the very beginning is how confident do you feel right now? Do you have your own personal opinions or ethical thoughts on whether or not animals should be treated for their oncological disease? It's a good idea to sort of like have an idea for yourselves whether or not you've got any fears, any apprehensions really, and also think about the knowledge, the baseline, what you have in order to look after these patients, what do you know already about chemotherapy in practice, and what are you able to do? So we're going to talk about that later on as we go through about all the different practices and what you can use with what resources you have already to be able to provide this level of care to your patients. So what do we aim to achieve from doing this today? So we essentially, we know why we need to help animals in practice and offer an extended level of care to them. But what I would like you to do is to be able to, by the end of this talk today, is describe why that's so essential, demonstrate an ability to do so, and help your nurse. I want to help you guys at home find your what is known as the zone of proximal development. So looking over at this graphic over here on the right, so this is what you can do, certainly in practice, with without any kind of support or any further learning. But I would say that the majority of you out there today who are listening to this talk is you're between the level of not being able to do something and being able to do something. So which is here, which is your zone of proximal development. So this is what I aim to achieve by the end of this session today. So the things which you can do now in practice with a little bit of guidance. So the learning objectives, we'll list them out because we're going to go through each as a section. So we're going to describe the need in practice to treat patients with chemotherapy drugs and the range of commonly used treatments available for your general practitioners prescribing them. We want to recognise the personal risks associated with handling chemotherapy and the risk to the patients receiving them as well. We are going to go over identifying the resources to safely deliver chemotherapy in general practice using a range of different treatments. And hopefully from that, you'll be able to go away and demonstrate the ability to tailor your chemotherapy practice for an array of different patients. Ultimately, if you're going to propose to look after patients from specialist centres and deliver chemotherapy in practice, it'll be a great thing to do to design a business plan to introduce nurse-led chemotherapy clinics to your practice. And I'm going to give you some ideas on how to go about that at the very end. So the structure of today is to introduce the basic principles of how chemotherapy works and how to go about safe work in practice, to share some of the professional materials which I've got on our huge catalogue of things here at a specialist centre and which I've developed myself. We're going to have occasional stop gaps for you to have a moment to self-assess your learning and just to reflect over the different sections. And then also introduce potential scenarios to provoke some deeper learning of the subject. So as we go through, I want you to think about situations which you may have been in and how you can develop, how you might have acted in that situation. Ultimately, we're going to signpost some resources, so point out things which are located already within your personal skill set and your practice capabilities so that you're able to offer these chemotherapy treatments in practice. So our first learning objective is to describe the needs in practice to treat patients with chemotherapy drugs and the range of commonly used treatments available to the general practitioners. So we're going to go over for what are the indications for chemotherapy in veterinary medicine, how cytotoxic drugs work, and this is only a very basic level. Obviously, spending so much time in practice for a number of years now, each of these sections could easily be broken down into a whole hour-long webinar. So this is just touching on the very edge of your taste buds in order to inspire you, to motivate you, to allow you to become a self-directed learner, somebody who's more inquisitive and wants to learn some more. Also, we're going to have a quick look at what chemotherapy drugs can be used in general practice and what are mainly deemed as many specialists safe to undertake their utilisation with normal cancer care. So chemotherapy, what is it? It's the use of cytotoxic drugs which destroy cancer cells. So cancer cells are usually rapidly dividing cells. They're angry, deformed, mutated cells which have come from a normal cell lineage which have been damaged in some way. The word cytotoxic actually means toxic to cells, and chemotherapy works by disrupting cancer cell growth and division at various different stages of the cell cycle. Now, cytotoxic drugs, as I'm sure many of you are aware, can affect normal cell growth. So they're not necessarily cell specific. They may act at a particular point within the cell cycle, but they can affect normal cells as well. So you have various different cells within the body which are also rapidly dividing, for example, the bone marrow, the hair, skin, and these cytotoxic drugs can affect those as well. Chemotherapy tends to be used as a combination with various different therapies, and that's because different drugs work at different points in the cell cycle. So in order to be attacking rapidly dividing cells, oncologists will often sort of like create a recipe, so to speak, of different drugs so that they can constantly be acting on the cancer cells whilst limiting the damage to the different normal cell lineage as well. So, cytotoxics in oncology, why do we use them? So there's three main reasons, and that's for systemic neoplasia or highly chemotherapy sensitive tumors. So if you've got cancer which is all throughout the body, or you've got a very high tumor burden, then the most common indication for chemotherapy for the common treatment is chemotherapy as opposed to surgery, for example, or radiation. You also have some very highly chemosensitive tumours for lymphoma, which is, can be a, not only a systemic disease but a local disease, and then the drugs act very, very well on those. They could be used for adjuvant chemotherapy, so that's almost like a mop-up, really. So this is post patients having some form of surgery, for example, in the case of an osteosarcoma, so a bone cancer where the animal might have had a limb amputation, or hemangiosarcoma, which are common in the liver and spleen. So if an animal's had splenectomy, there are risks that these tumours can still have some microscopic disease somewhere in the body, and because these particular tumours have a high metastatic risk, there's a possibility that another tumour can pop up somewhere else. So we essentially give them a form of medical treatment, so chemotherapy, to mop up, so destroy any potential metastases. The final indication is neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So that could be used prior to surgery or radiation, and it's to reduce the actual volume of the tumour. So they'll be given, for example, to a patient with a significantly large mast cell tumour to try and shrink it down, because for in the potential case that the tumour was too big to take it all off at once. If you think of, say, a mast cell tumour or a huge mass on the front of a forelimb, which then takes up over half the circumference of that forelimb, if the tumour is so large, then it's very unlikely through surgical excision you're going to get closure on that wound. And so oncologists will often use chemotherapy as a neoadjuvant treatment to reduce the size of that tumour before then attempting it full excision. Now, there is reason why cytotoxics may not be used for oncology or for oncological disease, and there could be because there's a more effective option. So not all tumours respond to chemotherapy. There's also that there's a lower risk option. Now, whether or not that's whether a lower risk to the people involved, for example, if you've got a patient that is extremely nervous in the clinic and you can't manage them, then even if you've got a particularly chemosensitive tumour, it may be that the risk to the caregivers is so high that you have to go for a second option, which may, for example, be radiation therapy. After that, you've got that, you, as I said, neoplasms that are not sensitive to the chemotherapy at all, or low grade or mitotic index tumours. So this is where tumours that are dividing, but they're so slow that when you give the patient the chemotherapy, it doesn't act quick enough or effectively enough, so that the tumour, you kind of miss the opportunity to damage the cell as it goes through the cell cycle. So that's when chemotherapy might not be indicated. So essentially, what is the goal of treating patients with chemotherapy? The biggest thing for myself and the oncologist which I work with is always improving quality of life. We're not there to extend their life, we're not there to cure the cancer, but it is purely focused on improving their quality of life. Now, that may come hand in hand with other sections which we've listed here. So stopping the cancer from going to other parts of the body, maybe slowing the growth of the cancer, killing the cancer cells to the areas of metastases, which we mentioned earlier, or ease particularly the symptoms that the cancer is causing to make the patient more comfortable. There is a phenomenon known as paraneoplastic syndrome, where certain tumours can cause an effect, so to speak, on another body organ or an endocrine level. So you might have a patient which has a significant hypercalcemia due to their lymphoma, for example. With that, they're polydipsic, polyuric. So when you give them the chemotherapy, they're ionized calcium levels drop, their thirst decreases, their urine output decreases, and everything normalizes. So there is sometimes that we just want to ease the symptoms as opposed to try and literally fight the cancer. The goal of chemotherapy can also change. This is important to remember throughout the treatment. So we always want to be improving quality of life, and that is the priority. But the goal of chemotherapy may start in the very beginning if you've got a very chemotherapy sensitive tumour, that you want to get that patient into remission, get them back to essential normal level of quality of life. But then as the animal gradually goes through their cancer journey, the goal of giving them chemotherapy may be to essentially palliate them. So it may be that they develop other concurrent morbidities. So the chemotherapy treatment is actually just to dampen down some of the clinical signs that they have instead. Now, we touched on a few moments ago on about chemotherapy agents, how do they work, and mentioned that some drugs are cell cycle specific, so that's where the CSS is here, which means they exercise their effect at a particular point. Now, some drugs work in all phases of the cell cycle, so that's the difference of really how long essentially oncologists have to time between different treatment cycles. If you have a drug which exerts its effect in only a very small areas of the cell cycle, then it's potential that that drug will only last a very short amount of time in the system, only capture a certain number of cells. But if you've got drugs which work in all phases of the cell cycle, then it can have a very prolonged effect, so a long duration of action. So I kind of think of the way that cancer cells or any cells in the body divide is almost like a fireworks display. It's not like a small army of cells that sort of like they all sort of put their feet together and salute at the same time and say yes, divide. What they do is it's like a an eclectic firework party, so they're going off and they're dividing at all times. So if you give a drug at a particular point, you might miss the whole party, and so that's the reason why the oncologists sort of come up with a formulation of a combination of different regimes, and look mainly really for two drugs or more that work at different points of the cell cycle. So they actually agents for how they exert their effects. So in various different ways, they can damage DNA to prevent the cell, the cancer cell, from actually reproducing. They can interfere with enzymes which are involved with the DNA replication. They can interfere with the DNA and RNA growth by substituting the normal building blocks of RNA or DNA, and that tends to happen mostly in the S phase. Or they can altogether stop mitosis or inhibit enzymes from making proteins needed for the cell reproduction. So all the food and the energy and everything that's needed to even initiate the cell division in the first place. So I'm just going to take you through some of the drug categories which we have with chemotherapy, which are quite commonly used in practice. So there are the mitotic inhibitors. So these are plant alkaloids and other compounds derived from natural products. So they've been extracted from a normal natural product. So this is just an image of the vinca alkaloid plant where vinblastine, vincristine and vinorelbrin are extracted from. The way these drugs work is they stop mitosis or inhibit enzymes from making proteins needed for the actual cell reproduction. They are most active during the M phase of the cell cycle, but can damage cells in all phases. So they do their very, very best at a particular point, but they hang around for a while, and then can exhibit their effect over a longer duration of action. And vinblastine, vincristine and vinorelbrin are used mainly for many different types of cancer, including mammary and pulmonary neoplasia, myelomas, but mainly lymphoma, leukemia. These drugs are also known for their potential to cause peripheral nerve damage, which can be a dose limiting effect, and we've mentioned the examples below. So there's the second category of drugs which are commonly used in practice are the alkylating agents. These damage DNA to prevent the cancer cell from reproducing. So then you have your natural killer cells that come in, and you have those stop points within the cell cycle, and then your natural body's response to that is to then destroy the cell. They're not phase specific, so in other words, they work on all phases of the cell cycle. So they're damaging the DNA as it's unraveling, as it's sort of like reproducing. They're used to treat very many different types of cancers, including leukemia and lymphoma, multiple myeloma and sarcomas, as well as cancers of the lung, mammary and the reproductive organs as well. Alkylating agents are used in veterinary medicine, which some of you may be familiar with, which are chlorambucil, cyclophosphamide and melphalan, and lomustine and dacarbazine. The platinum drugs that we also use, cisplatin and carboplatin, which are commonly used for osteosarcoma or anal glands, anal sac, anal adenocarcinomas, are sometimes grouped with the alkylating agents because they kill the cells in a very similar way. You also have the anti-metabolites as well, which interfere with DNA and RNA growth by substituting the normal building blocks of RNA and DNA. Now, these are very active during the S phase, so a very, very short phase throughout the cell cycle. So it's important that these drugs are timed or given over a long duration of action. Now, one of the drugs in particular we use is cytarabine, and it's given as an infusion over a period of time because it doesn't last very long in the system. So some people in practice are using cytarabine for GME, for neurology patients as well. And they give the drugs over a set period of hours. So they give multiple injections every 12 hours so that the drug goes into the system, works on this S phase, or captures as many cells as possible, dividing during the S phase, and then they have another injection again. When it comes to chemotherapy, we use the anti-metabolites to use various different types of cancers, mainly leukemias or cancers of the reproductive organs and the intestinal tract. But it also has been used for sort of rescues in leukemia, for example, lymphoma, sorry, for example. Some of us may be familiar with 5-FU. We've just mentioned cytarabine or gemcitabine, which is a sister drug of the cytarabine. Or there's hydroxyurea and methotrexate as well. Now, we also have the anti-tumor antibiotics as well, so anthracyclines. These are anti-tumor antibiotics that interfere with enzymes, so the essential building blocks that are needed for the DNA replication, the food, so to speak, and the keys to unlock everything that's needed with regards to the DNA splitting and changing. Now, these drugs work in all phases of the cell cycle and have a very prolonged effect, and so often need to be given in cycles with long duration of action, so big gaps between them. The main two really are doxorubicin and epirubicin. These are probably the two drugs which a lot of clinicians in practice are more nervous to use, so because they can have various different effects, not only on the patient over a long period of time, but also in their treatment as actually giving them. So a major consideration is that they can cause permanent cardiotoxicity when given with patients with pre-existing cardiac disease. So these are dogs which are predisposed for with DCM, for example, dilated cardiomyopathy. So often clinicians will ensure that they'll do an echo or they'll refer an animal for a heart scan to see whether or not they've actually got any predisposed or pre-existing condition. Now, these drugs also have what's known as an accumulative effect in relation to their dose. So the more you give the drug, the more of a cardiotoxic effect that they have. And so for this reason, you have lifetime dose limits placed on these drugs. So you can only give these drugs a certain number of times. And then finally, we've got corticosteroids, which are also really the backbone, the bare minimum, really, for when it comes to chemotherapy treatment. So these are natural hormones and hormone-like drugs that are useful in treating some types of cancer, in particular lymphoma, leukemias, and multiple myelomas. But I'm sure you're familiar with them being used for many other things in practice. When they're given to use to kill cancer cells, they essentially slow down their growth, and so considered part of the chemotherapy protocols for the aforementioned treatments. The examples which we have in practice are prednisolone, methylprednisolone, or otherwise known as solumedrone, and dexamethasone or calvazone. Now, a common question I often get asked is the doses of what we use, how were they comparable to human medicine? Now, they're very, very much reduced, if not by half, sometimes less than that to a third. And we calculate our doses based on meters squared versus mgs per kilogram, which we're more commonly used to. We also have to be very, very aware of a body condition score as well. So essentially, what we want to make sure is that if we've got an animal which is based on their milligrams per meter squared, so their meter squared is a conversion from an animal's weight to a surface area. If you've got an animal which has got a high body weight, but it's because they're overweight, then it will push up their meter squared, which will increase their dose. So we do need to be very conscious that we don't overdose these patients. There is also sometimes we do a muscle condition score as well. So to be considerate of patients which are otherwise cachexic or lost a lot of muscle condition, and that could be due to their underlying cancer or whether or not they've been chronically on steroids. What we do is we have a specially designed protocol for these patients, which are established from human medicine and ongoing veterinary research. You may be familiar with what's known as the COP protocol, for example, which is a common treatment regime which is used to treat lymphoma. And a lot of clinicians in practice are very happy using this protocol. It's essentially a recipe on how to look after these patients using three different drugs. Now, an example, another one here is the VAC protocol, which may be used for patients which have had a hemangiosarcoma or soft tissue sarcoma. They often use they're acronymed into the initials or the first letter of the drugs that are used. So a VAC is a combination of vincristine, the anthracycline, or otherwise known as doxorubicin in this example, and cyclophosphamide. So you have your cycle, which is a full 21-day cycle, which is listed out here. So on your first day, the patient will be given doxorubicin, usually at a dose of 30 milligrams per meter squared. They would work out what the patient's weight was, convert it into meter squared, times that, let me just get the marker so you can see where I'm at. So times that by the 30 milligram per meter squared dose, and then that would give how much would be given to the patient. You can write any notes to say how it went, and then list out the dates. Some of these treatment regimes are really good for the clients to keep hold of. It really helps with them remembering of when their next appointment is or when their next dose is as well. And then on day eight, so 7 days later, the patient would then move on and have their vincristine, which would be given at a dose range. Now, essentially, it does very much depend on the clinician, their confidence of how happy they are with regards to what kind of dose range they want. Sometimes the big guns in this treatment protocol is the doxorubicin. Some clinicians may be a little bit uncomfortable at giving a patient the full dose to start with. Doxorubicin is an extremely highly GI toxic drug in some patients which can be sensitive to it, and so they may start off with a smaller dose, a lesser dose of either a 10 or 20% dose adjustment, so they may go down to 27 mg per meter squared and see how the animal tolerates it. What happens with the cycles is after day 15, another week goes by, and then you start again on the second phase of your cycle. So if the patient tolerated it well, the clinician's confident, they then may up it to the 30 mg per meter squared. Now, so what chemotherapy drugs can essentially be used in practice? Realistically, it comes down to how knowledgeable the clinicians are, what experience they've had, what safety mechanisms you have in place to make sure that the drugs are given safely and you can deal with any adverse events of the patients, how you can get those drugs in to be supplied, and also what storage facilities you have as well, and how you're going to look after the waste. So it does come down to essentially a conversation between the team and also the knowledge and experience of those that are going to be using them. So was added in quickly here a quick quiz. So we've got three questions here. So what is the primary indication for administering chemotherapy to the veterinary patient? What unit of measurement is usually used to calculate chemotherapy? And which drugs class have the most significant effect on the heart? I'm just going to give you a moment to have a look at that, and then we'll add on the answers. So I'm sure those of you, all of you that have been listening, do agree with me that the most important thing is to improve the patient's quality of life. That's the indication for administering chemotherapy. What unit of measurement is used, and that's milligrams per meter squared. Which drug class can have a significant effect on the heart. So that was one thing we went into a little bit earlier, which is the anthracyclines, which are anti-tumor antibiotics, or doxorubicin are all the right answer. So moving on to our second learning objective, which is to recognise the personal skills personal risks, associated with handling chemotherapy and the risk to patient receiving. So the risk to patient is that these drugs are very myelosuppressive. They decrease the ability of bone marrow producing cells. They can have an impairment on the organs. So the way that the drugs exit the body or how they exert their effects can have an effect not only on the cells of we talked about that they can have a problem. An effect on normal cells as well as cancer cells. There is a risk of extravasation injury, which is damage to the surrounding tissue at the site of the injection. So these drugs are very potent, and if they don't go inside the vein, then they can cause a lot of damage in the local area. You can have a sensitivity reaction, like anybody, any one of us patients are the same. There are certain breeds which can have a sensitivity reaction to certain drugs or certain patient drugs, if given a numerous amount of times, can increase sensitivity with those. Less common though in animals as opposed to it is with people, is there's can be giving chemotherapy can be associated with hair loss, urinary incontinence, behavioural problems, and I've put in here carcinogenesis. So some of the drugs have the potential to cause cancer, ironically, which we're going to cover in a little bit later. So what do we have to do with regards to our patient monitoring? So every single time they come in, when they're going to get chemotherapy again, and since they've had it, there needs to be a full history done since their last treatment. That includes a full physical exam, quality of life assessment for each visit. We want to perform a complete blood count before each chemotherapy administration, because as we said, that the drugs have an effect on the bone marrow. So we want to make sure that their blood count abilities actually work and has recovered since their last dose. Patients treated with some protocols also have a high prevalence of neutropenia. So even though we expect them to have a neutropenic effect, some have a high prevalence or a longer duration. If their neutrophil count is less than 2 times 10 to the 9, we often treatment delay them just to make sure that they have a chance to recover, and we're not going to give their bone marrow an ongoing onslaught. There may be additional measures needed to prevent GI adverse effects. They should also be taken. And ideally, an assessment of the cardiac contractibility should be performed prior to the first dose of anthracyclines and before reaching the cumulative dose of 180 milligrams per meter squared. So if you remember, we saw that the dose of doxorubicin on the VAC protocol was 30 mg per meter squared, and we noticed that it was 6 cycles, that's 6 times 30. So you can't repeat it past or give doxorubicin further than the 6th dose without checking their cardiac contractility again. In certain breeds, some dogs have what's known to be an MDR mutation, so that's in collies, Australian Shepherd dogs, etc. And this is a mutation which is found on the actual membrane of the cell. It means that they don't have the cell doesn't have the ability to pump out the drug. So the drug gets into the cell, does its effect, whether it's a cancer cell or a normal cell, and then it can't push that drug out. So what ends up happening is it has an accumulative, a constant effect, and then these animals can, whilst it's great if they've got cancer and it kills off those cancer cells, it has a very negative effect on normal cells. And then, as we mentioned before, after a certain number of cycles, what we want to do is restage these patients to see whether or not the drugs that we're giving is actually working. Now, things can still go wrong in the clinic. So we mentioned about hypersensitivity and extravasation injury. On the left here, we've got a vincristine reaction where a patient was given vincristine, which ended up going outside of the vein as the drug moved. And you can see that there's quite a nasty of demarcation around the cephalic site where that was administered. A lot of the time they are able to be well maintained, well controlled, apart from one of the drugs which I'll mention in a second, which is the doxorubicin. And it's always worthwhile to have a specialist kit to hand just in case these kind of things happen. Most of the drugs that we use do have almost a remedy, so to speak, and you can limit the amount of damage that's done On the right-hand side here is a picture of a dog which had L-asparaginase. So the dog had an injection of L-asparaginase and then it was given again. And as I mentioned earlier, sometimes the animals can have an increased hypersensitivity as the doses go on. Now what we do is we keep what's known as our emergency extravasation and anaphylaxis kit. So it's all stored together in a toolbox. And I've listed out here, this is a copy of one of the little cards that we have, and we do regular stock checks on it monthly. And we have like a little key lock on it, like a pull tag. So if the pull tag was ever damaged, then we'd know that someone's been in it and we'll need to check it. But at the same time, it also makes sure that it just keeps it closed. It makes sure that no one goes in just to grab something, just in case. And there's a list out there of the kind of things that we use. Now, here there's a list, an example of what you would do in the case of there was an extravasation of vincristine, vinblastine or vinorelbine. So what we do is we don't expect everybody to always remember to know exactly what to do in the very rare, unlikely event of an extravasation injury. So what's important is not only have you given the nurses these training, but you give them a very, very clear system of work. So just in case something happens. So almost like a list of like you do this, you do this, you do this. And we have this for every single one of the drugs that we have in the clinic, making sure that we've got all of the treatments that are needed, so that it's very, very clear how to action it. We want to also, as part of this learning objective, is recognise the personal risks associated with handling chemotherapy. So the risks with regards to the caregiver is we know that these drugs are carcinogenic because they have the potential to cause cancer and also be mutagenic, so they can change our own genetic material, which is usually DNA of an organism. We also are aware that these cytotoxic drugs can be tetragenic as well, so they can disturb the development of an embryo or of a fetus. So what I want to just go through in the next few slides is essentially to be very mindful of this, and not bury our head in the sand and think that everything's just okay to use them. Now, how can we be exposed to these cytotoxic drugs? Now, this could be done through the handling of the patient waste, the preparing and the administering of the drugs, accidental contact with a known agent, or unprotected handling of the known agent. So consciously sort of going about just getting on and getting things done can end up putting yourself and also your colleagues at risk. Now, cytotoxic drugs can be get into the body through skin or eye contact, ingestion, inhalation, unfortunately accidental injection, and just at general absorption. Now, the focus really on handler safety, there's a lot of evidence been researched into and is provided by the International Agency Research on Cancer, which has been built up over the years. Now, it started off in the 1970s of the University of Helsinki that reported traces of chemotherapy agents were found in the urine of oncology nurses when they were doing routine screening. That extended into the 1980s, where nurses reported they were experiencing side effects which were very similar to chemotherapy patients, including nausea, vomiting, hair loss and mouth sores. Again, then it moved into the 1990s where they developed wipe studies. So they would use specialist wipe cloths, which then went off to labs, which usually went through a series of very specialised tests that found that there was contamination that appeared in approximately 75% of samples taken from working areas. Now, this wasn't necessarily just the working areas within where chemotherapy was prepared or administered, because as it developed through the millennia, they found that these studies continued to find hazardous drug contamination throughout the pharmacy and all different nurses' settings and the urine of the oncology staff, underpinning essentially what they had done for the past 30 years. Unfortunately, what was most worrying that it wasn't actually found in those staff who were directly involved with the preparation process or the handling or giving chemotherapy. For those young spring chickens amongst us, you may remember the workplace contamination adverts which they had in the 1980s, where they set about highlighting a chicken on a board on the side in a kitchen, and they went round with this chicken and they turned all the lights off, and then it transpired how people in the workplace, or in this image here, of the video still is essentially someone who had handled chicken and then gone round and prepared salad. So you've got all these highlighted areas where they've touched different things, including their head, their face. There's a bowl of vegetables on the side, and contaminated essentially those areas with bacteria. If you think about that, well, it's also you can put that into play when we're barrier nursing patients. We go up to a patient, we know that it's got infectious diarrhea or something like that, and you've got your apron, you've got your gloves, you've got your barrier nursing, and you might have shoe covers, things like that. And then you're halfway through doing something with the patient, and it's like, oh, I need some paper roll. And it's really interesting thing to observe when you next have a patient in, to observe a colleague who then needs to go and get something, and watch what they touch and watch what they end up going to get, completely unconscious that they could be spreading bacteria around or something infectious around the room. Now, the reason why it's such a concern for the IRAC is essentially that the concern is that when working with cytotoxic or hazardous drugs, we're unconsciously spreading things around the work environment, which is what evidence has now found and proven that we need to be very much more mindful. Now, so therefore, when we administer cytotoxic agents, we need to safely reduce the risk to as low as possible. And by doing that, we need to find a suitable environment with suitable attire, suitable equipment, and dispose of all waste in the most efficient and practical way. It's also important, like what we mentioned before, about having safety kits in place, but also spill kits available to make sure that if there is any accident that occurs, then everybody is perfectly prepared. I mentioned before about the IARC, so they actually classify all of the cancer drugs into different bands, but as well as that, they classify different types of carcinogenic substances. And now, while I said I don't want you to be burying your head in the sand and not be worried about it, then I've just explained how dangerous the drugs could be. At the same time, I just want to go through some of the things which are listed here. So we've got when you look into the different categories, you've got something which is a 2B, so possibly carcinogenic to humans. So this is like coffee, gasoline, welding fumes, and funny enough, pickled vegetables, which is quite ironic. Now, this means there's limited evidence in humans and insufficient in animals to demonstrate that these substances do have a carcinogenic ability. Now, if you then go up to 2A and then group 1, anything that's classified as group 1 is carcinogenic to humans. So I'm sure everybody is aware that the link between smoking, exposure to sun, radiation, alcoholic beverages and processed meats have a carcinogenic effect on humans. And this has been demonstrated with scientific evidence, and a causal relationship has actually been established. Now, whilst I don't want to put the fear of God into you all, we do know essentially that, as I say, the IARC has categorised all of the drugs that we work with. And here's a small table here of some of the ones that we work with here at the RVC. And you can see, let me just get my drawing pen again, you can see that there is, sorry, I'm just supposed to be drawing. You can see in the third column that there is a list of the IRAC categories, which then list out how carcinogenic these drugs are. So you can have a look on the third and the sixth column with the drugs that we use, and most of them are in 2B or below. So now, why I don't want you to think, well, that's nowhere near as dangerous as smoking or having a Pinot while sitting on a beach in Hawaii. What it does mean is that we are aware of a small relationship to their carcinogenic ability of these drugs, but the most one we need to be very, very worried about is the cyclophosphamide, which, funny enough, is actually a drug which is used very many times in various different medical situations for immune-mediated disease as well. So this is the one I want you to draw the most attention to and remember from this talk today that you need to be most careful with, and especially when talking to your clients. So a quick moment to test your learning. So really, what is the term used to describe the cancer-causing effect of a substance? What is the most common adverse event of chemotherapy to the patient? And which drug commonly used in practice is classified as the highest IRAC category? I'll just give you a moment to do that while I take a sip of water. So I'm sure you've all got it, that the term to describe cancer-causing effect of a substance is carcinogenic. The most common adverse effect of chemotherapy to the patient is myelosuppression. We listed that as the top. And cyclophosphamide is the highest risk category drug that we use in practice and need to be most mindful of. So moving on to our next learning objective, which is to identify resources to safely develop chemotherapy in general practice using a range of treatments. Now, we mentioned before about the suitable environment, attire, waste, disposal of waste, the equipment, and the safety techniques. And I hope you've been thinking as we've gone through these, the kind of things that you already have in practice so that you can undertake chemotherapy treatments to your patients. Now, the most important thing is to wear personal protective equipment. So we want you to be wearing gloves, which are a chemotherapy grade. These are otherwise known as nitrile gloves, but the gloves which are chemotherapy grade have it listed on the box somewhere. They often have kite marks with them as well, and they will say that they are chemotherapy proof or non-permeable to a certain level. We use here long sleeve water resistant gowns. They're thumb loop gowns, so you can put your thumbs through them and then your gloves over them, and they're really readily available for JAK. I put here consider a face mask and consider goggles, and that does all depend on how you're actually going about administering chemotherapy, which I'm going to touch on in the next few slides. So the desirable equipment is to have a dedicated room. You want to be doing this somewhere quiet with all necessary equipment. It's great to have a chemotherapy specific administration system. So that's in the case where I'll show you on the next slide. It's a specific system which is designed to reduce the risk of contamination as you're drawing it up and giving it to the patient. Now, there are also ready to use drugs available. Now, this can be done by a patient coming in a couple of days prior to due and having their chemotherapy. They're weighed, they're given their physical exam, their chemotherapy is calculated. And there are suppliers out there, veterinary suppliers, who already prepare the drugs for you and ship them out to you. So this is what you've got here, so in this top left-hand picture. And they'll provide you quite often with all of the closed administration systems as well to try and give them as safely as possible. Ultimately, the most ideal thing is having a designated safety cabinet, and this is what's considered the gold standard to be drawing up these drugs. Now, here on the right is our lovely nurse, Rachel. She's our senior oncology nurse here. She's actually in the process here of drawing up chemotherapy using a closed system. There is evidence out there to show that there's one particular system, and I'll show you now. This is the Farseal kit, which is the only system which has come, they've developed a research paper to show that the transferal of drug from the bottle into the syringe, so the drug actually connects up via a little device here. So the syringe is here, it ends up with this cap, it locks on to the top of the vial of the bottle, you turn it upside down, you draw the drug out. And so this is the only system so far that has published research against the other systems that are on the market to show that there's a lack of sort of like leakage around the injection point here. So when it comes to administering chemotherapy, the important parts of it are is good restraint, comfortable patient. The patient needs to be comfortable, and as well as the team. This is an example image of a patient that's receiving doxorubicin, which is given over 20 to 30 minute infusion, depending on your clinician preference. The problem with this is that you've got a patient who needs to be very, very comfortable and still for that period of time. And you, in doing so, you often put the patient's comfort in front of the rest of us. We have now like mattresses for the patient to sit on. We try and get ourselves comfortable. We have bean bags in order to get ourselves into sort of like, we call it dog yoga positions, so that they're nice and comfortable. You can see this patient on the right here is like dozed off to sleep while we're actually giving him his chemo. It's essential that you have a first stick secure catheter for IV treatments. This means that the catheter goes straight in the vein, no drawing back, no redirections, no nothing. It goes straight in. There's a lot of different opinions on whether or not you can use that same leg again. We do, so we always aim to start off at the distal end of the limb, trying to when it comes to placing a catheter. And if we're not successful, we will alternate to a different leg. Especially when using a drug like doxorubicin because of the extravasation injury risk, or vincristine, for example. But some clinicians are happy if there are no alternatives. And when you're giving patients with something like the CHOP protocol, when you're giving patients chemotherapy every week for up to 28 weeks, what ends up happening is that you do end up having nowhere where you can go. And so as long as you go very, very much far away from where your original venipuncture site is, you can go higher. We always encourage everybody to use lure locking connections. So these are screw-on syringes as opposed to push and twist. And always flush your catheter before and after with 0% saline. Never use heparin within our flush syringes. And the reason being is that because some drugs can precipitate in the presence of heparin. Always work over an absorbent pad and be very careful throughout. So observing the vein for extravasation. So every single time you push any kind of fluid into that vein, always observe for a small bubble. Observe the patient throughout for signs of drug-associated immediate side effects, so nausea, anaphylaxis or cardiotoxicity. Some patients can flush blue for a very short period of time when using drugs like listed here with the one demonstrated here with doxorubicin. And then flush the catheter and then remove the catheter. Only very rarely will we leave catheters in sight. We'll dress them all up completely to make sure that nobody can put anything else in it without using full PPE. And that may be because we've got a hospitalised patient who is very sick and therefore requires some form of venous access. And then dispose of all of our consumables into a cytotoxic waste bin. So what about subcutaneous injections? So cytarabine, gemcitabine, bleomycin, L-asparaginase, for example. So the PPE that we use must include a mask and a visor, and this is because we are unable to prepare or administer chemotherapy via this method, using this method via a closed system. We need to make sure we use swabs around the neck of the bottle. So as you put your needle into the neck of the bottle, wrap it with a swab. And this is where a fume cabinet is a very, very much a major advantage. You can clip patients over the injection area. So this is something we do just to make sure that you can see the needle going into the skin, into the subcut, and then you drop the skin and then inject in. And you should see a small bubble under the skin, which indicates that the drug is all within that containment site. And then the needle comes out and you wipe the area with the glove. And maybe consider a dressing, like just something to cover the area if the animal's going home and there's small children in the house. Also, there's tablets and capsules, so we must make sure that we don't crush them or break them. They should never be opened. The client should always be recommended that that's the case as well. Drugs should, you can get them reformulated if necessary. So when the clinicians and yourselves are calculating the drug dose, sometimes they don't fit in with a certain tablet availability. So there are labs, there's Noble Lab for one of these here, all getting them from a specialist centre who have sent off tablets. For example, Lomustine comes as a 40 milligram capsule. So we send off our capsules and they have them specially weighed, recapsulated into smaller sizes, which are then better for smaller patients. Always wear gloves to administer them and dispense them in a child-proof container. One good tip here is to cut your blister packs into strips and insert them into your child-proof container. So obviously never pop them out of the blister packs, just cut them into individual ones and then pop them into the pot here. It should always be on the forefront of your mind to maximise patient safety techniques and record keeping. Working within safe doses ranges, checking their nadir, so checking their complete blood count before they have their chemotherapy, double checking calculations and checking against the last dose, checking the right dose and the right patient. This is an example here, which I'm happy for you to use and within your practice. It's our chemotherapy sheets. which essentially have, oops, sorry, it's our chemotherapy sheets, which list out all the different things which our patients have. So we've got our patient name, their patient number, the date, what drug they're having. And then it's like being back at school. So you have their weight, you convert it into meters squared using a formulary or a specific drug calculation. You times it by their dose, which then equals the total dose. And then you divide that by the concentration of the drug to give your volume in mils. You can tick off then whether the drug's going IV, intramuscularly, subcutaneously, or intracavitarily as well. And then what we do is we double check our doses. So I would, if I was doing the drug calculation, I would complete all those parts, put my initials here and hand this sheet to somebody. It's their job to go through and double check their weight, their meter squared, what dose has been prescribed, and check my end volume before signing it off. I would not be standing over them making explanations of why their weight is this or things like that. Their job is literally on the information that's available to them, see whether or not this volume is exactly the same and countersign it. We would then present it to the clinician and who would say that their blood count has been checked and they're okay for chemotherapy, and then we'll go ahead. You can add any notes you want here with regards to patient restraint or how many attempts of venipuncture was done, undertaken, and then which vein was used, what batch number was recorded, have they been charged, and who was responsible. And this sort of like encompasses all the things which you need with regards to chemotherapy safety and good record keeping. It's important as well that we observe the legislations associated with storage of cytotoxic drugs. Chemotherapy is identified as a hazardous substance according to the Health and Safety Executive, the RCVS and the VMD. Now, recommendations include rigorous record keeping, controlled storage, efficacious waste control, and minimal risk of harm. We must record the traceability of exposure and reported spills or accidental exposure, as well as document that all of these incidents are documented and investigated. So when undertaking chemotherapy in practice, you must make sure these systems are going to be available and ready in place. Handling of body waste. So the ECVIM have guidelines and risk periods for how long drugs are likely to stay into a normal patient's bodily systems. And these have been investigated and recorded in a scientific way. Unfortunately, these are slightly out of date. I think it's 2002 in which this evidence goes back to. And there are new papers emerging to state that certain drugs remain either for more or less in the system. However, most oncologists do observe these guidelines. And there's just a brief image of how we've drawn them up in our practice for when we've got patients that are hospitalised, how long we need to be observing risk periods for. Suitable disposal of waste. So all of cytotoxic waste should be labelled as such. Be mindful to try and initiate in practice whether you can have designated cytotoxic bins. Cytotoxic waste bags should be double bagged, labelled with the date and area. Luckily for us, because we use so many, they're already pre-printed. The paperwork all should be labelled for the carrier so that it's very, very clear. We have purple topped bins over here on the left for our sharps. And a new device which is quite recently on the market is this here, which is called the PactoSafe, which is fantastic because what it does is it uses a heat element off of a foot pedal down here to heat seal bags of waste. So it works really, really well, not only for cytotoxic waste, but also infectious waste. So it heat seals sections, and then you can just cut a section through, and then it just goes into your cytotoxic bag and you just zip off the bin. So essentially from this learning objective, I'm hoping that we've taken from it that we can work responsibly, not bury our head in the sand and pretend that it's not happening, not go completely and utterly over the top when considering the IRAC risk categories, but also at the same time, we're not going to stop these patients having the drugs because we're not familiar with what we need to do. So realistically, now moving on to the identifying resources within our practice to be able to give our patients a range of treatments, I want you to take a moment to think whether or not you have or can have a safe and quiet working environment. You have excellent phlebotomy skills because it does take good skill and patience to make sure that you're able to catheterize these patients and deliver chemotherapy. Luralox syringes and administration devices, these are very easy to get. Whether or not there are an availability of agents from hospitals, or you can get them from wholesalers or veterinary chemotherapy companies, that you've got all available resources to deal with an accident or an acute adverse event. By that I mean a spill or a extravasation injury. And you've got resource materials, because you're going to need to inform these clients and colleagues about the waste risk management. So just take a moment to think how much of that you've got in practice and how achievable it's going to be for you. Okay, so hopefully by now you've been thinking about what you can do in practice, and you're going to be able to, hopefully, when you start undertaking this kind of activity with regards to your nursing, you can then tailor your chemotherapy practice for an array of different patients. Now, the typical chemotherapy appointment which I see are a patient that comes in, they have their history and a quality of life assessment done, which in itself is a huge area of nurse development. We do a physical exam, so, and then we debrief that to the veterinarian. We take blood and urine samples. We ideally, if you've got in-house facilities, it's a real bonus because you can fast track everything. We're involved with the chemotherapy calculations. We give those results to the clinician, and we get the yes or the not okay for chemotherapy. We undertake that patient treatment, and then we organise their next appointment, price them, make sure their records are sorted, and organise their discharge paperwork. That involves a huge amount of client liaison, and is an integral part also of the patient discharge. Now, this can, when you do have a clinic, this can evolve to a stage where you become very, very familiar with the needs of the clinic, how patients come in, how things can work really well. And so patients, and essentially also the client, can be trained, for want of a better word, to not only manage expectations of what everybody's trying to achieve, to streamline what would be a classic appointment, so a patient that's coming in for a routine vincristine injection or an ADEER check, which is your CBC check, establish therefore what works really best for the client and the team, so what times of days work really well for you. These patients can be trained, literally. They're so excited. This is Dexter on the right. He is my favourite. I know we're not allowed favourites, but he was and is. He would come in and he'd be so excited. So he'll be sitting there with his dad. He was the most obedient dog in the world, maybe because he was a Labrador and very, very food motivated. But he'll come in, he'll sit next to his dad, eyeballing me with his tail wagging, thumping on the floor while we're doing a history. And then he's literally on my heel, off to the weighing scales. He'd get a reward for sitting there. I'd write down his weight, take him to the ward, do a physical exam, another small treat. Then he'll have his blood sample, urine sample, another small treat. Everything was very, very exciting for him. And the whole small episode of giving him the chemotherapy was very well managed. By that, we were able to introduce specific nursing care plans for all different individuals that come into our clinic. We have important notes to remember, like, do they prefer to lay in a particular way? Do they like a mattress? Do they not like a mattress? Are they better on a front leg, a back leg? What treats do they like? Are they more orientated around toys or like, you know, interaction, as opposed, because we do have animals that don't want to eat in the clinic. They just want fuss, or they want a tennis ball is one of them. And because what we want to do is, the ultimate is have the patient and also the client to feel that the process is as unclinical as possible. Because this is going to be a regular thing. They come in often nearly every week for some chemotherapy protocols, and we want it to be fluid and easy for everybody. Not forget about cats, of course. My experience, slick work in practice will ensure the best possible outcome. So, but by doing so, it's really important to ensure a cool down period after their travel, because they could be wound up about that. A quiet area away from dogs and potentially other cats, so keeping the cat in one place from the beginning to the end can be hugely beneficial. We use local anaesthetic creams or sprays. So we've got Ethicalm here, which is a topical spray, a coolant spray, which is a concentrated alcohol, or Emla, which takes a little bit longer. So if you clip them and prep them, that's long enough often for then you've done your physical exam. If you do that first, then you can do your physical exam, debrief to the clinician. All of these things can start be working before you then have your fluid phlebotomy skills to take your blood sample or place catheters. I would say here, don't be scared of a mild sedative. So butorphanol we use if needed at 0.3 mg per kilogram. But then the other thing is it's not wrong to admit defeat. Some of these animals, whether they're cats or dogs, some animals are treatable versus non-treatable. You've got to be remembering what we're trying to do each time is we're improving their quality of life. We want them to be happy. And if it means coming to the practice every week and it becoming an ordeal for them, that is a quality we're removing from them. And it does harm not only the carer to patient relationship, but also the client to patient relationship as well. So there are certain things which we can pick up with our nurse consultations. So the relevance, the signs of patient response, and subtle signs of client fatigue. So the way we are able to identify that is to really be understanding in the protocol what these animals are having. Be very aware of the drugs used and the likely adverse events, because you will centre some of your questions around them. One example is going back to cyclophosphamide. It is a carcinogenic drug, not only to the handler, but also the patient that's being administered it. And it has been associated with causing a secondary cancer of the bladder. And so it can also cause a sterile hemorrhagic cystitis. So if you've got a patient that's on cyclophosphamide, it may be a good idea to be a little bit probing about that animal's toileting habits, which then you can then tailor, as I say, key questions around them. The other things are, when you're looking after patients with having chemotherapy, is it's very important that their appetite, their toileting, their exercise tolerance, and their nausea and their vomiting are particularly paid attention to. Check that these treatments have been given on time, and if any supportive medication have been needed, to clarify when and how much the effect that they had on that symptom. Ask the client to summarise in a few words at the end how they think their pet has been during this treatment. Some will be like, oh my goodness, he's back to his normal self. Some will be like, not such a good week. So these are subtle things which really, really help you pick up on how everybody's doing. Check always at the client if they've got any questions. The relationship with a nurse to a client is very unique compared to the client and the veterinarian. Often the clients will feel a lot more comfortable in asking some very, very sort of poignant questions, which are important for us to decipher and communicate between the caregiving team to be able to help them. We have specific history forms which we have as prompts for these questions, which are really, really useful. So they list out all of the different things that we want to ask for a variety of different patients undertaking different treatments. And when you become more experienced, you know which questions to probe a little bit more about. Always try and give an estimated time. As I said, if these clients are coming in for a hot light every single week, it's really important that we try to sort of manage their expectations and also get the patients processed as quickly as possible, because these clients may be having to take an hour, 2-3 hours out of their work life, picking up the children. They might have a dependent on them as well at home. So trying to keep within that time estimation is really, really crucial. There are signs that you may become aware that things aren't going so well. So you can probe a little bit more about how medications be administered. It's quite amazing that if you ask if they've given the patient a certain tablet, and then you say, how did you do that? It turns out that the client has been chasing Fluffy around the house for half an hour, dragged him out from underneath the sofa, pill popped him with his cyclophosphamide, and has been bitten twice this week. You know, things like that are going to damage the relationship and the whole point of what we're trying to achieve here. Ask if the patient's staying clean or asking to go out at night. Patients which are on prednisolone, for example, they increase their thirst and their urine output. And sometimes when you actually ask that probing question in a subtle way, the client will turn around. I've had them say, oh, I sleep on the sofa now, I set my alarm every hour so he can go out, things like that. It's not going to create the best bond, and it's going to fatigue the client really, really quickly. I like to ask the subtle question if the client thinks the animal is comfortable. I don't like to say, do you think they're in pain? I will do, and I will explore that further if they hesitate too much or they're very, very much in denial. And sometimes they'll be like, yeah. And then you can just probe that a little bit more and say, well, why do you say that? Explore it a little bit further. I like to ask how the client is as well. Like tie it in with a question about, you know, if they've said, oh, well, I'm sleeping on the sofa, I'm setting my alarm every hour. And it's like, well, how are you coping with that? It is a really sad thing. And it takes a brave person to ask these questions, because our job is to really, as veterinary nurses, we're very focused on looking after the patient. But for me, I really do find that what we're doing is we've got a dual level of care here, not only to the patient, but also to the client. If that patient's not doing well, try to cross-reference to their original presenting signs, which could demonstrate a relapse. So if you've got a patient which, for example, it's got a transitional cell carcinoma, so a tumour of the bladder, and they're suddenly now increasing their urine output again, this could be a subtle sign that after a period of time when everything's been going well, there's been no blood, there's been no problems with the urination and the toileting, that subtle increases in that, or the patient's now asking to go out at night, could be a warning sign that the treatment is failing. It's also a good opportunity to review expectations. So the quality of life here is a really good true value. So again, I think it is a really, really important thing which you can explore with your clients as you develop these bonds throughout their cancer journey and these regular appointments, to review the expectations of how that animal is doing. Just subtle things which you're able to add in, like, oh, is he still getting up to, you know, welcome people to the door and things like that, really just brings it to light for the client sometimes when their expectations seem like they're just constantly trying to battle the cancer and they don't want to admit defeat in any form. So the nurse's role in symptom management really is, as I said, is a vital role of offering support for many, many different things, including the management of adverse events. The symptoms can be very well managed if oncologists can recommend a first aid kit of supportive medications to address negative clinical signs as they develop. By that I mean nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, so some of the general GI toxic effects that chemotherapy is commonly also associated with. Treatments can include anti-sickness medications, anti-nausea medications, anti-diarrheal antibiotics, appetite stimulants, and gastric protectants. Now, our role in that is to advise when to initiate these treatments based on symptoms, and thorough and vigilant record keeping through your client communication system can establish a really good tailored regime to manage each individual's clinical signs. So get on top of them sooner rather than later. Now, what we have is we have a mailbox, so clients are able to email in to either give a daily update, to say that they've got a concern, and we'll phone the client back and have a conversation to see just kind of how that patient is, whether or not they can initiate any of this first aid support, or whether or not they need to bring the patient back to the clinic to be looked at further. That supportive role does extend into for the patients and the families. So I mentioned before about establishing rapport with these clients in the early parts of the treatment schedule. So understand really what role that pet plays in the household will allow for appreciation of how that human-animal bond is so significant in that household. I've worked with families whose their pet they could be a pet or they could even be a working dog, and these clients will undertake chemotherapy for working dogs because they actually end up with such a good quality of life that they can go back to their essential role in that household, which is fantastic. It will also allow you to gauge how committed the owners can be and how tied they are. It's interesting to learn sometimes when you start having these conversations with clients that there's normally a story, unfortunately, associated with them, that it's the last link to a deceased partner, or the children have left home and this is all they've got and things like that. So it's really important to establish how committed this client is and what the relevance of that pet's role is. However, saying that, our role should always be focused to promote the patient's comfort. So we should be able to provide rationale for any intervention, and ensure the time for the family's questions. So by that I mean, we do need to be able to justify when a client needs to take a few minutes to understand why we are offering the next stage of care, why this may not be another treatment may not be suitable for the patient, and be able to be there to answer any questions. We're there to provide education regarding their treatment, so aid discussions around pain management, quality of life, palliative care, and end-of-life support. And I feel very strongly that anybody who is embarking or facilitating care for old or terminal patients, I really recommend that expanding your professional development with bereavement training will better equip you for the journey ahead. Even the most calm and compassionate and experienced colleagues I have seen really, really struggle with some of these situations without some of the key skills which can be shared through enhancing your professional development through these methods. So from all of that, I hope that we've got through, we've expanded our knowledge here. So this is a learning theory called Bloom's taxonomy, which essentially demonstrates that we have a certain level of knowledge, which before that we then are then able to comprehend. So really, really understand what we're doing rather than just know about it. Now, some of us may have started at the bottom, but I'm hoping now we've got to a point where we are able to apply some of what we've learned today. Others within us will be analysing what we've got within practice, so really breaking things down as to what we can do, what we can change, and then some of us, in addition to that, may be getting to the point where we want to be putting things together, and deciding how we can actually really, really get this in practice, and maybe even make it something which we can have really, really robust and be offering a level of support service when it comes to introducing nurse clinics. Now, essentially, nurse clinics, for those of you that have had little experience with preparing a business case, the process can be really daunting. It's important to try and have a mentor for support that can help and guide you through this process, or utilise any online resources that may be able to help provide a template to work from. I like the model that's listed here, which is Hatchet, which is actually from human medicine, and it's based on 10 essential steps to set up a nurse-led service. And I just want to take them through you quickly for these last few slides. So step one is building the business case, explain why the service is needed. Now, with the number of specialist oncology centres increasing, there is a definite trend in the demand for veterinary oncology care. It's not uncommon for most referral centres to be keen to return cases back to their primary practices for ongoing care, so which have huge, huge benefits within for the clients. Not only for travel expense, but for us as professionals. So more patients can be referred, more patients can be treated, we can broaden our knowledge. Obviously, there's a degree of profitability in there within general practice, but also it increases rapport and the client service. Now, in first opinion practice, can become the first if first opinion practices can become much more confident in the understanding of the care plans involved, I believe that chemotherapy care could reach a much wider population of patients. Following that, I think so step two is your aims and objectives. You should be really clear about what you want out of this clinic and its associated objectives. It will help you clarify what is being offered to your patients and clients within the capabilities of your practice resources. You can help establish what patients meet the criteria, so what service you will offer, ensuring that it's within the remit of the veterinary nurse, so which patients can be treated using which drugs and which protocols, how confident are your colleagues with they may be happy with certain protocols but not with others, and is there availability to have support from the most local specialist centre as well. Phase two, really, I think, is the important details when developing a business plan. So, you important part is selecting a location. So, deciding, sorry, where and when your clinic will run. Questions to consider will include. So, can an area be specifically allocated for the clinic and the administration of cytotoxic drugs? Can the clinic be scheduled at a regular time which is convenient to the practice and the client? Bearing in mind what I mentioned earlier, that if you've got patients coming in for a weekly treatment, you may have to consider opening up your clinic early so that these patients can be dropped off and collected later on in the day so that the client can attend work. Can the clinic be run with minimum disruption to the rest of the practice services? Is the area which you want to use large enough to accommodate everyone and everything needed? Do you have kennel space to keep animals in for the whole day to have their treatment? Is it close to other areas in the case of an emergency? So is there colleagues which can be contacted really, really quickly if needed? Do you need to consider any computer access and the necessary facilities to carry out your work effectively? And is there likely to be any opposition or problems when using the facilities that you need? So is there competition for using space within your practice? Is that going to be a problem? Now, the next thing is really to look at multidisciplinary support. So gain support from your colleagues. Ensure that they recognise the need for this service. Although the term nurse-led implies a strong degree of independence, the clinic is, of course, part of the patient's broader healthcare pathway. As many veterinary clinicians are becoming more comfortable with diagnosing and managing oncology cases, mainly, as I say, using the vinca alkaloid protocols, we must remember that this is a collaborative method of case management, inclusive of other care providers, so the veterinarians, receptionists, care assistants, and also potentially other specialist centres. So in case if you've got a question or a concern with the animal's ongoing care, do you have a local specialist centres who are going to be able to help you and support you? I would suggest that you start before commencing a clinic that you talk to key professionals who may refer into your service as well. They can offer you education, advice, and support. Here at the RVC, we're very, very keen for local practices or referring practices to undertake chemotherapy and look after patients for ongoing care. And we're more than happy to offer that education, support, advice, and support. Consider also what you may need to suggest in terms of adjustment and adaptation, or if you feel the service is actually warranted at this stage. The business case is invaluable here when making a clear argument regarding the need for viability, if you've got all of your colleagues who are backing you. Professional development. So essentially ensure that you're able to maintain and expand your competencies. This is one of the most important elements of a nurse-led clinic as it underpins what you're able to do. I've drawn here upon my 10 years of oncology nurse practice to share with you only but an hour of this exposure, and I still will continue to learn new things every day. One of the main problems with learning a new subject is the educational deficit, which is what I said at the beginning. Essentially, we don't always know what we don't know, which may be termed like an unconscious incompetence. I would encourage you to reflect over the material today and further your knowledge through self-directed learning. Break down each of the sections that we've gone through, and initiate discussions with your colleagues. Do further research in the fields. And for each part, there's information out there on webinars, articles, or even book chapters. CPT Solutions also have other oncology-based webinars in the library from my colleague Irina Grammer, who's a new colleague here at the RVC. So second to that, as I say, reach out to local specialist centres who are very open to sharing their knowledge and broaden that care delivery to the wide range of patients. Then you've got the consider your medicines management. So as I mentioned before, it's important from the Health and Safety Executive, the VMD and the RCVS that you need to be very careful in managing these drugs. We've discussed these legal and practical considerations, and as because they're classified as hazardous drugs, they've got to be handled with care by trained colleagues. Treating patients with chemotherapy and supportive care medicines, it's going to be the hiatus in ensuring a smooth delivery, and it must be managed really, really responsibly. I encourage you to consider how to manage these medications in your practice to best suit your service. So how or where they can be stored and administered, who is responsible for the safe handling and management, and include in, thoughts into how practice and patient records are going to be maintained, and most importantly, how you're going to enhance your professional development in this area to be fully aware and competent in this field. And then so really, essentially, the final phase is putting it all into practice. The clinic won't succeed if patient and referrers don't know of its existence and what service is going to be offered. So plan your publicity well. Publicity can fine-tune the planning stage as it may prompt final discussions that lead to a adjustment of the proposed service. These changes may improve the service for patients and those who refer in. So posters, leaflets, web information, group discussions and visits to those who may use it can all highlight what the service is about and when it starts. Information about what to expect can be sent out with appointment letters, and finally client resources, I suppose, for home care in the form of tangible information delivered during your consultation and discharge process is always going to prove invaluable and time efficient. Kind of last couple of steps really, so plan and audit your evaluation. So consider how you will measure the effectiveness of the service and the service users. You can do that through feedback, questionnaires, budget performance, case numbers. So seeing how many patients are being treated, how much that may contribute to the budget of your practice income. Get feedback from your colleagues, from the clients. But remember, this is always an evolving service. Everyone's got to start somewhere. So a part of good business planning is to consider when a review would be most appropriate. So essentially asking the question, are you making a measurably effective difference, and when can you measure that? And then last but not least, closing the loop. So facilitating any kind of ongoing improvement is the very end to a business a good business proposal in the auditing, evaluation and reflection side of things, is to attend to all the administrative detail that you've gathered from the evaluation data and looking at any particular action points or recommendations. These details are only going to be valuable if the team reflect on that performance objectively. You can consider where job descriptions, responsibilities, equipment, facilities, publicity or pricing can be reviewed and then make adjustments over time. So realistically, oncology nursing is part of the future. It involves a huge amount of nursing abilities, so coordination of care, patient assessment, direct patient care, client education, symptom management and supportive care. This is I love this picture. This is Jenny, who's absolutely crazy. She's actually a recently qualified degree nurse who came straight to us at the RVC as an oncology nurse, saying that she wanted to do something different and expand her skills. And she has been a huge asset. So she's going off traveling for a year because I think we might have broken her. No, not really. But she essentially has brought so much to it, because we learn so much of this as part of our university, our apprentice courses, of how to do all of this already. And then you can build upon that and really, really reach out and look after these patients who are an evolving level of practice, which is the future. I hope now you can have a good think and see how confident you feel, whether or not your personal opinions, your ethics have changed, if any of the fears or apprehensions have changed. If I hope that your knowledge has expanded and you feel much, much more able to go into practice, have a conversation with your colleagues, your clinicians, your practice managers, and see whether or not treating animals with chemotherapy is something you can all undertake. So high five with going through this. I have overrun ever so slightly, she says. I think that was almost 90 minutes. You are very welcome to contact me. My email address is at the bottom there. I do run a sort of a form of a consultation service as well, so I can come in, have a look at your practice, give you some pointers, things like that as well. Have a look at the other resources that CPD have out there. CPD Solutions, as I say, have Irena's on there, which is about introducing diagnostics, nursings, and supporting the clinicians through the oncology stages of working the patients up. And that's all for me done. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Nicola for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.